Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last Friday, May Day, tens of thousands of people marched in cities across the country demanding comprehensive immigration reform. From San Francisco to Boston, the focus echoed the issue that dominates our national conversation about immigration. How should the government deal with millions of undocumented workers inside the U.S.? But behind that story and that question is another contentious question about how welcoming a place the U.S. should be for a different kind of immigrant. With the economy shrinking faster and farther than any recession since the Great Depression, is it still a good idea to bring in tens of thousands of high-skilled foreign workers to U.S. universities and corporations? On today's Your Call, we're continuing our Monday series, Agenda for a New Economy. And today we are focusing on foreign workers in the high-tech industry. Many innovators in Silicon Valley come from overseas. 42% of engineers with master's degrees and 60% of those with engineering PhDs in the U.S. are foreign-born. So are they still an asset in this struggling economy? Should high-tech companies like Google, Yahoo, and many others do more to hire American workers, or is it too difficult to find the skills they're looking for? Joining us to talk about the role of foreign workers is Matt Richtel. He covers technology and telecommunications for the New York Times. Last month, he profiled Sanjay Mavankurve, an engineer for Google and one of the founders of Facebook. Sanjay works from Canada because his wife can't get a work visa here in the U.S. Matt Richtel also writes the monthly column VC Nation about the venture capital industry. His novel Hooked, a thriller about love and other addictions, is now out in paperback. And Matt Richtel joins us from the San Francisco Bureau of the New York Times. Hi, Matt. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. We are also joined by Professor Vivek Wadhwa. Professor Wadhwa is a fellow with the Labor and Work-Life Program at Harvard Law School and Executive-in-Residence Adjunct Professor at the Pratt School of Engineering at Duke University. And Professor Wadhwa joins us on the line from Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Professor Wadhwa. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. How are you doing?
Nice to have you. We are also joined by John Miano. He is founder of the Programmers Guild. He founded this advocacy group in 1998 because he says he was concerned about foreign workers replacing programmers like himself. And John Miano joins us from New Jersey. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Nice to have you. Well, Matt Richtel, let's start with you, because last month you profiled Sanjay Mavankurve in a piece called Tech Recruiting Clashes with Immigration Rules. So talk about Sanjay and his story. Who is he, and what are some of the barriers that he's facing trying to come to the U.S.?
Well, Sanjay is a 28-year-old who was born in India, and he wound up, his family traveled to Saudi Arabia when he was very young, and he grew up there, and he was very obsessed with all things American growing up. He and his brother used to play a game when they were in the car in Saudi Arabia, which was name everything out of the window you could see that came from America. And his fascination, his brother's fascination with America, ultimately manifested in an application to Western Reserve Academy, a high school in Cleveland that they got accepted to, and they got a scholarship. And one thing led to another. He wound up at Harvard. He did some early programming on a site that wound up contributing to Facebook. He's an exceedingly bright guy by all the standard measures, SAT scores, and so on and so forth. And he joined Google. And in several years ago, he was on an H-1B visa. And do you feel like you want that defined, or you have a sense of that?
We have a good sense of that. That's the temporary worker visa.
Temporary worker visa, of which there are a limited number. And then he fell in love. He fell in love with a woman also from India. And the H-1B visa work rules do not allow his wife to work in the U.S. And so he's moved to Toronto, where he works in a satellite office from Google. There are four Google. According to Google, it is much better for their productivity, their efficiency to have people in the nest, able to be face-to-face, able to have spontaneous conversations. And for them, Sanjay is one of many, many people whose inabilities to be close to the campus hinders their competitiveness. He also underscores the great, great complexity of this issue in that, as folks associated with John Miano will tell you, well, there are lots of people who would love to live in California and love permission to be here. And as a nation state, we have rules, and we're trying to navigate those rules. And right now, those rules force Sanjay to make a choice. His choice is to live in Toronto so his wife can work, rather than live in the U.S. on a temporary visa and have her not work. You know, I could go on, but that sort of outlines him biographically and him as a symbol of where we are today.
And is his story fairly common?
Well, I would say yes and no. The no first. No story is completely common. Each of these stories is quite nuanced, which makes it one of the harder issues to legislate. Mm-hmm. There are people with all kinds of issues. You know, for instance, in this case, he would like to get a green card that would enable his wife to work. That takes longer than a temporary work visa. In that respect, he's not, you know, no, he's nuanced. But he's also, when I talk to academics in the field, scholars like Vivek and others around the country, they say it's actually not that uncommon where a temporary work visa allotted to one spouse makes it impossible for the other one to work. And so we lose one very qualified foreign-born worker who, because the rules are too rigid with regard to the spouse.
And before we get Vivek and John to lay out their arguments, is it true that Google has to prove that they cannot find a worker in this country that does the tasks that Sanjay does?
It is true that's the goal. I'm sure John will give you a different view about whether or not Google actually does that. But from what I was able to see, and they let me pretty well into their infrastructure, they spend quite a bit of money going through the rule system that demonstrates that a particular worker is necessary, and that no other worker could fulfill just that job. But I would let John speak to that, in Vivek, because it's a very, very complicated question you ask about whether the rule system does enough to protect the American worker, or for that matter, goes too far in forcing the companies to prove that they need someone who will really help their ability to compete.
Well, let's... John, was that you?
Yeah, this is John. I was just interrupting. I can answer that.
Sure. And John,
no
let me just...
whatsoever.
And let me just let listeners know who you are. So John is the founder of the Programmers Guild. He founded this group in 98 because he says he was concerned about foreign workers replacing programmers like himself.
Right, and now I'm a lawyer. And I will say there's no requirement whatsoever that Google make the slightest effort in any form to find a U.S. worker before getting an H-1B worker.
Actually, a good point, John. We should distinguish. I'm thinking of green card there and not H-1B. So
for green card,
fair point. Yes, fair point. Fair point. On the H-1B, it's a different issue.
Okay. And so let's lay out your arguments, John and Vivek, about this question. Are foreign workers still an asset in this struggling economy? And Vivek, you were recently part of a number of people who commented on the New York Times, do we need foreign tech workers? And you argue that highly skilled foreign workers are leaving the country in droves, and the U.S. is no longer the land of opportunity.
Rose, if you look at Silicon Valley, what happens is that you have the ups and the downs. When there's a down, people get laid off, and they have little to lose at that stage. And then they typically get together and they start, you know, pooling the ideas and starting companies. Those companies take a while to get going, but eventually they create lots of jobs, and that fuels the next revival and the next boom. That's this cycle of boom and bust that happens in the Valley. The problem is that because of this distorted H-1B visa, we have a million skilled immigrants here right now with their families who are basically stuck in immigration limbo, who are waiting for green cards. And the wait times for countries like India and China are longer than a decade. It could be 15 or 20 years before many of them get green cards. And the result is that they're working for the same company. They're at the mercy of the employer. And this is what John and his group are complaining most about, that it distorts wages. And, you know, to some extent, that's true, that you do have abnormal forces at play over here. And the problem is that we're disadvantaging the United States as a whole. We're disadvantaging our economic recovery by keeping these people trapped in this immigration limbo and not fixing the real problem, which is, you know, giving people the right to start companies, to buy houses, and to do their good that they do in the Silicon Valley.
So what is your answer to fixing the problem?
Well, I would basically, if I was President Obama, I would pass a law which says that any skilled immigrant who's here on an H-1B visa already, who wants to start a company, can qualify for a green card after 3 years if their company employs more than 10 workers, and or if they buy a house for more than the median price of a house. What you would have is you'd have 100, 200, 300,000 houses being sold. You'd probably have tens of thousands of startups which would generate hundreds of thousands of jobs. So I'm not talking about taking any jobs away. I'm not talking about importing cheap labor. I'm talking about legalizing the people who are trapped in limbo right now.
John Miano, what about that?
Well, I think that Vivek is describing the rather exceptional cases. I mean, we're importing nearly 120, 130,000 people a year on H-1B visas, but very few of them are starting companies. The most of it, I mean, for example, DHS just did an audit of H-1B visas and found violations in 21% of them. Like here in the Northeast, like in Connecticut, we have U.S. workers at Pfizer being fired and replaced by H-1B workers. Down in Florida, at AC Nielsen, we have U.S. workers being fired and replaced by H-1B workers. So that's the majority case, is the abuse. So we have to deal with the majority of the abuse of the H-1B program first before we start dealing with the exceptional cases of the small number of H-1B workers who found companies.
John, I got news for you. It's not the exception. It's the rule here. You're talking about the exception. You're talking about the few abuses that occur, and you're talking about companies which are doing things they shouldn't be doing. But the fact is that immigrants who founded 52% of Silicon Valley companies typically did so 13 years after arriving in the United States. You know, you and your folks keep attacking what you call low-level, underpaid programmers. You know, I was one of those. When I entered the United States, I was writing code. I was writing COBOL code, in fact, and I was one of them. I went on about a decade later to found two companies. The first one employed over 1,000 workers. The second one employed about 200 workers at its peak. So it's people like me who come in here on, even as low-level workers. The fact is, when you have bright people, when you have people who are well-educated, when you have people who are motivated, they do good things for the economy, and we need as many of them as we can get. The solution isn't to close the doors and to protect the elite, middle-aged programmers. The solution is to open up to free trade and allow the market to do its magic.
Okay. Well, the thing is, we don't have free trade. We don't have an open market. And as I always say, that if we're going to have an open market for labor, we ought to have an open market for businesses and everything else. But we don't have
America.
That.
It's capitalism. It's America. This is not Cuba. It's not Korea. We're talking about the greatest country in the world, which is what it is because of its open markets, because of its freedom, because we've been open to ideas and open to innovation.
We don't have open markets, Vivek.
I'm sorry, John, we do. I know there's some problems here.
We have open markets when the lobbyists set the rules up to benefit the businesses.
And we're going to break in just a minute, but I want to ask Matt Richtel, is this about H-1Bs and the law behind that, or is this a much larger issue?
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, these guys are getting at a ferocity of a discussion that has been brewing really since, the 1920s. When we had a big sustained level of immigration, and we're seeing the biggest wave, sustained kind of wave of immigration since that period. And it was at that period that we started asking really tough questions about who do we admit to the country and why and what are the rules. And at that point, we started to see the first definitions of skilled immigrants as a part of our discussion.
And hold that thought, Matt. We're going to take a quick break. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco. It's 20 after 11.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our daily newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about people living with mental illnesses. There's a new movie out called The Soloist, and if you get a chance, check it out and then give us a call tomorrow and let us know what you think. Do you think that this film will help our understanding and connection to the mentally ill, people living with things like schizophrenia? Do you think it'll maybe question stereotypes about homeless people who live with mental illnesses? We'd love to hear from you. What have you learned from your own experience with mental illnesses or the experiences of others? That's tomorrow. And then Wednesday, we will be speaking with Paul Buell and Harvey Pekar. They have turned Studs Terkel's Working into a graphic novel. So what does working mean today? If Studs Terkel were alive today, who would he want to talk to get a full sense of working life in America? Maybe some people living and working in Silicon Valley. That's on Wednesday. And if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation about foreign workers, you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also give us a call at 866-798-8255. If you work in the high-tech industry, are you seeing a changing attitude towards foreign workers? And if you work in an industry filled with foreign workers, what kind of impact have they had on the industry you work in or your workplace? 866-798-8255. And if you've recently lost your job, do you think the government should make it harder to get work visas, or should they restrict companies that get stimulus funds from using it to hire foreign students at U.S. universities or at U.S. corporations? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Today we're joined by Matt Richtel. He covers technology and telecommunications for the New York Times. Last month, he profiled Sanjay Maven Kurve, an engineer for Google who is living in Canada because his wife can't get a work visa in the U.S. You can find his piece at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Professor Vivek Wadhwa. He's a fellow with the Labor and Work Life Program at Harvard and executive in residence, adjunct professor at the Pratt School of Engineering at Duke University. And John Miano, he's founder of the Programmers Guild. He founded that in 98 because he says he was concerned about foreign workers replacing programmers like himself. He's now a lawyer in New Jersey. And Matt, I know we have to leave you in about 8 minutes. So give us a sense of, when you did your reporting on Sanjay Maven Kurve, what did you hear from, you know, people working at Google, and what did you hear from people saying that they should do more to try to find Americans to fill jobs that Sanjay Maven Kurve currently hold?
Right. Two great questions, two separate questions. The first one, the people at Google see their task as fundamentally borderless. They see the world as their market. Software is easily transferable. It can be reproduced and manufactured with a button push, and so these nation state border lines don't exist. They need, in their view, they need people who can create products for these markets, who can understand these other markets, these overseas markets, and then they say, in a technology world like ours, in a business like ours, we're competing against the littlest startups in Eastern Europe or in Mexico or anywhere else. They have access to the great talent in those countries. If we are truly going to be the best, we need the very best people in the world, because that is the playing field now. That's the argument inside Google, and they have really built a company that feels very global in nature on its campus. That's their view. The view of others that, I'm sorry, the second question was?
Groups you spoke to that said Google should do a better job of finding talent in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, basically, one of the interesting comments I got was, well, why isn't Silicon Valley writ large going out and doing training? Why isn't the community doing a better job of dealing with education, investing in projects that promote engineers? That was one very interesting view that I got. I do know that as a whole, Silicon Valley has been very active politically in urging for more money to be spent on engineering and math and science. I'm not sure what the individual companies do to promote education in that regard, but that's one of the chief questions that I was asked.
Were you able to ask Google that question?
I didn't ask Google that question. It's a fine question. Just one last point on this, because I am going to leave quickly, and
sure.
I can't wait to hear your other two guests really go after it, because it's a great conversation they're having. But you know what? I think a prevailing question that I heard from everybody, and John would ask, is there's lots of unemployed, bright people. What is the difference between the American-born skilled engineer and that one particular engineer that Google or Intel or HP says they must have? What is so special about Sanjay, or his equivalent? And what the hiring companies will tell you is, we want to have our pick of the litter, because we are at the pinnacle of competition in this world. And there are tiny nuances, whether it's a competitive edge, a zeal, an intellectual horsepower that a particular person has that no other person may represent. I mean, that's such a intensely interesting question. How do you compare two people? It's almost like, how do you know who you're in love with? And I mean, I'd be interested in having these two gentlemen speak to it, because it really is a terribly difficult question for everyone in the situation to answer.
You put your finger on the key issue here, that's what the problem is, that we need to get the best and the brightest, and not just anyone who is unemployed, and that's what it boils down to.
And Matt, we have to let you go, but do you have time for one caller?
I have time for one caller. Okay. Can I just answer one? Just finish the question
sure.
we started with before
yes.
the break. Why do I think there's such ferocity? And a big question here is, I think we are very broadly seeing a breakdown of the nation-state barrier through the internet and other things, and it's scary as heck because it's a kind of chaos that we're not sure how to digest. We've had these borders for a long time, and underlying this discussion we're having is a kind of political and economic anarchy we don't quite know how to digest. Yes, I'll take a caller for sure.
Okay, great. Let's hear from Terry in Seattle. Hi, Terry. Welcome to the show.
Hi. The first thing I'd like to say is Professor Wadhwa talks about the free market.
Terry? I think we lost Terry. Terry, if you're still listening, you could give us a call back. We had a problem with your line. Let's hear from Susan in Palo Alto. Hi, Susan.
First off, I'd like to say that it is not a meritocracy in Silicon Valley. I've lived and worked here for 20 years. We have extremely talented U.S. citizens who have built Silicon Valley, who are being replaced by individuals who are coming from body shops. Your Wipro, Infosys, Satyam, those body shops are, by and large, downgrading the salaries and shipping in foreign workers on the H-1B. They're fine. They take a lot of the QA and testing jobs. By far, there are some people who are H-1B people who are very bright. By and far, it is not the rule. People who built Silicon Valley are being displaced by these workers due to salary considerations. I worked at Google. They do hire very bright people, both American citizens, both workers, but the average company is purely going on cost of the labor. This is terrible for our economy and for the future of our computer science graduates who are American citizens who can't get jobs due to the lowballing of the salary.
This is a big question, Susan. So based on your experience at Google, you're finding that foreign workers are paid less than American workers? And
this is a big mystery. The companies keep that data very secret. No one actually has a handle on it.
But is that when you have conversations about these issues, is that what people assume?
Oh, actually, okay. So folks that I know, I'm employed, that are employed and that are not employed, know by definition, you get people from India, a programmer, a tester, a QA person, that person is by far getting paid a low salary. Yes, the Infosys, the body shop folks especially.
And Susan, what are you hearing from people working in high tech? Are their opinions about foreign workers changing because the economy's
upset at the system? People are not upset at the workers themselves. People are not racist in general. They understand that these people have families. They want to come to America. America is the best country on earth. It's the best place to have a job. An American job is worth so much in this world today. Everyone wants to come to America and have a job in America. If you have a job in America, you've got gold. Everybody wants it. So in general, the people that I know don't dislike them. They don't like the system whereby they're being displaced and replaced with folks who only occasionally have better qualifications and more skill. Myself, I've interacted with a lot of the foreign workers, and by far, I can say they're mediocre. They're okay. Many of them get trained when they're here. This is a big problem that American workers have, that they're training these people who are coming in, and then they're losing their jobs. I know a woman at Sun Microsystems. She was a tech pubs manager. She had to train her replacements and all their team, and then she was fired. Mm. These are the problems.
Susan, thank you for calling. Sorry to cut you off, but Matt has to leave us. Matt, Susan brought up a number of points. One of the large ones is the pay scale, that she says that she believes that it's bringing down pay because foreign workers are paid less than American workers.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is probably one area where I'm sure they'll correct me if I'm wrong, where Vivek and John have some agreement. I think that everyone on all sides of this agrees the system is not perfect right now and that there can be some wage depression. It's sort of I guess everybody's doing, the advocates of the system would do a cost-benefit analysis and say, well, we gain more than we lose in depressed wages, but I do think that both gentlemen would agree, and if I'm wrong, I'll be gone, and I won't have to, off the call, I won't have to hear that I'm wrong. But I think they both say that the system is broken to some extent, and regardless of their position, agree that it needs to be, there needs to be better monitoring of the wage system. I've got to run. Thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you, Matt.
All right. I'll look forward to the podcast.
All right. Thanks for joining us. That was Matt Richtel. He covers tech and telecom for the New York Times. You can check out his latest piece. He profiled Sanjay Maven Kurve, an engineer for Google who works in Canada, not in Mountain View, because his wife can't get a work visa in the U.S. You can find his piece at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Professor Vivek Wadhwa. He's a fellow with the Labor and Work Life Program at Harvard Law School. And John Miano is founder of the Programmers Guild. That's an advocacy group he founded in the late 90s. At the time, he says he was concerned about foreign workers replacing programmers like himself, and he's now an attorney. So let me get both of you to respond to Susan's concern about wages. Vivek, based on the research you've done, are foreign workers paid less than American workers for doing the same job?
Rose, there can be distortion of salaries there because especially if you're on an H-1B visa and you're 6 years into your green card process, the company knows that you're not going to go anywhere and lose your turn in line.
Right.
So therefore, they won't give you the same increase that they give the American next door. So there is abuse of the system, and there are a lot of problems with it. So I can't defend the H-1B visa because I've never been a big fan of it. But the fact is that skilled immigration is good for the U.S., and that's what I'm arguing for.
And John, what are your thoughts on that? Have you done much research into the salaries?
Yeah, that's actually one of my big areas. And if you have listeners who are interested, they can go to www.cis.org for the Center of Immigration Studies, where I've published a lot of stuff. The majority,
hey, John, that stuff needs to be peer reviewed. I know you and Norm Matlock have published a lot of stuff like that, but it's often it really needs to go through a process.
It does get reviewed.
By whom? By your friends, basically. You really need to put it through a rigorous
process.
Everybody gets,
unfortunately, who does your enemies review yours?
No, I mean, I have other academics who work with me who basically know what the process is.
Way.
A lot
this
of the stuff you publish is
verified
bogus.
Verified by other sources, including an industry lobbyist who admitted in congressional testimony that I was correct.
John, I got to tell you, the stuff you and Matlock, even Matlock, he just makes up numbers out of nowhere. He says, I did this study, and here's the numbers.
Okay, well, let me
one
get...
paper like 7 years ago.
All right, I think we can agree that there's a question about salaries, but we don't want this to get too abstract because we want to make sure we, know, we bring in callers and talk about this essential question about what foreign workers contribute to Silicon Valley and should the laws be changed. John, did you want to jump in?
Majority of H-1B workers in computer fields earn wages in the bottom 25th percentile of U.S. wages.
All right. Well, we have a number of callers on the line, so let's go next to Ram in New Jersey. Hi, Ram. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I was going to talk about the amendment to the TARP bill, but I just want to clearly point out that that 25 percentile, a bottom 25th percentile salaries, what just John said, it's a total myth. Forget it. I can say that with full confidence. Anyway, the other thing is, John and Noam Matlov or whoever is talking about H-1B program is rife with this and that. 20% of the applications are actually fraudulent as per CIS. So,
are what? Can you repeat that?
John just pointed on the show that 20% of the applications are fraudulent. It's not 80% of the applications are fraudulent. But what John and others are asking is, rather than asking for enforcement, they're asking for uprooting the whole program so that there is no path to any sort of permanent residency, because H-1B program is the conduit to the employment-based immigration right now. I mean, when I say that, 90% of the people who become permanent residents in the employment-based system are coming on H-1B. And that's why it's like a divide-and-rule concept. John and others employ very smartly, saying that it's like when you say, oh, okay, what kind of immigration are you for? Oh, I'm not for illegal immigration, but I'm for legal immigration. But when legal immigration comes up, there is another thing. So it's the same old British divide-and-rule concept. And then the second thing I wanted to point out is I just can't fathom how detrimental it is to actually add an amendment to the TARP bill that says we can't actually hire people or foreign workers who have been by companies who actually accepted money through the TARP program.
Hmm.
And Bank of America resigned it on 50 such students who have been educated in the United States schools.
Right.
So we have lost on those 50 students who went to NYU, Columbia, and the Dukes and the Harvards. And second thing, that sends a ripple effect across the world, telling the whole people, oh, okay, let's go to London Business School next year, or INSEAD, or ESAID. Why should I go to NYU? Why should I go to Stanford, or why should I go to Harvard?
So Bank of America actually rescinded offers because of the stipulation in the TARP funds. So
yes, it is.
Right. So John Miano, what about that? So Ram is arguing that look at all of these people that you're losing as a result of this amendment and this law.
I disagree entirely with his assessment of the TARP restrictions, and I think that the TARP thing has been completely overblown. This is what actually were in the so-called TARP restrictions. One, the TARP recipients are not allowed to replace U.S. workers with H-1B workers. Okay. Do you think that's? I don't think that's unreasonable. Second thing is they had to recruit U.S. workers in good faith. Take out an advertisement. They're saying that they're looking for the best worker. Make them actually work. Look for a U.S. worker. And the third restriction was they could not hire a less qualified H-1B worker if a better qualified U.S. worker was available. That isn't stopping anyone from getting anyone. Plus, the only paperwork required to do those restrictions is two boxes needing to be checked on a form. So there was no burden put on the employers, and all the restrictions were perfectly reasonable.
And what about Ram's argument that this sends a message to potential students? You know, I'm not going to study at NYU because I won't get a job, so I'm going to study in London, for example.
I mean, I think that that's an exaggeration. But I think that it's being promoted by the spin of the TARP restrictions. I mean, people were looking, this is exactly, I told you what's exactly in the TARP restrictions. If you go and then run stories about, America doesn't want you, we put these onerous TARP restrictions that keep, that in most of the publications said that they prohibit hiring of foreign workers, which isn't true. So I think that the bad message is being put out by false information about the TARP restrictions.
John, I teach at the Duke Engineering School, and we have a large number of foreign students. And I tell you, they're not getting job interviews anymore because employers are telling them off the record that they're afraid of negative publicity. Mm-hmm. When Senator Grassley went on the tirade and started saying that the company should fire foreigners first, it really sent the wrong message all across the world. And it sent a shiver up the spines of a few generation of students here. They basically are now thinking twice about coming here. Enrollments have actually dropped from India, and they will drop in other countries. So I'm seeing it firsthand. I don't know what you're saying or who you're talking about, but talk to students in the engineering schools.
And
how many TARP recipients are hiring engineers? I don't think that many banks are hiring engineers.
Yeah, no, but the 50 MBAs, this wasn't even engineers we were talking about. This was 50 MBAs. What that did was it sent such a nasty negative. It didn't save one American job, but it'll probably cost hundreds of thousands of jobs because other countries are seeing America as being protectionist, and they're saying, well, if Americans can do it, we can protect our jobs too, and we won't buy American goods. So we're going to cost the jobs of hundreds of thousands of hardworking Americans who are making $15 an hour, $20 an hour, not the $50, $70, $90 an hour that computer programmers make.
I don't have any control over people making big claims like you're arguing about here. I can just talk about the actual abuses in the system that need.
I know, but I'm seeing it firsthand. I have students, who I teach who are affected by this. That's really what's bothering me. I'm very sympathetic to those who are losing their jobs. I really, really am. But what we're doing is that we're making the pie smaller for everyone. We're hurting everyone here in the process.
Well, all I've been calling for is a rational system.
I agree with the rational system. In fact, I agree with you on many, many things.
All right. Well, I want to thank Ron for calling in. We have full lines, so let's hear from Terry in Seattle. Hi, Terry. Welcome back.
Thank you. I just want to make sure that everybody understands back to the core concepts of why the visa program was created. This program and any visa program or supply-side immigration is nothing more than a way of controlling the cost of labor in this country, okay? And Professor Wadhwa, I'd like to ask you a question. What part of the free market system says that you're free to engage in whatever profession you want to and rise to the top of that, not only in experience, but in what you make, like doctors and lawyers in this country, until you meet a certain limit, which then says we're going to bring in foreign workers from another country? You use the word elite. You didn't want to create, and Alan Greenspan just last week said the same thing. This is all about the cost of labor. He said, we can't have another elite profession in this country. We need the visa program to keep wages down. The best and the brightest doesn't wash. I'm sorry that college students that have come from other countries are going to have a problem finding a job. But the deeper question to ask is, why are there so many foreign college students in this country? What's wrong with our kids? How come they can't go to school to be engineers? Why do we need to bring in people from out of the country when we have millions of children that are perfectly qualified to go to school but can't afford it?
Let me try educating you on how the world has changed. First of all, take Hewlett-Packard. 69% of the revenue comes from abroad. 66% of IBM's revenue comes from abroad. 57% of Caterpillar's revenue comes from abroad. The world has changed. Our companies are getting revenue from abroad now. Growth is abroad. So if we're going to be dependent on foreigners, on foreign countries, on foreign individuals to buy our goods, we can't close the door to them. We can't say that, hey, we want your money, but we won't allow you in our country. We don't want you to be part of our success. Basically, the world has changed right now. We can't be protectionist anymore. The solution here is to make the pie bigger, to have more startups, to have more innovation, have more entrepreneurships, double the size of Silicon Valley so you have millions more jobs being created. You don't win by closing the doors and saying that we're going to be protectionist and we're going to raise barriers.
Terry, are you still with us? We dropped Terry. Well, Terry also brought up the question about just the education system in this country. And Vivek, when you think about foreign workers and, look at just the poor state of education in this country, what are your thoughts on that? Because, he brings up a good point that, science is, a lot of teachers are being asked to teach science who are not qualified to teach science because of budget cuts, for example.
Rose, I've got to agree with Terry on that's an issue. I mean, I want more American students studying math and engineering, and I want more American students versus having to have our universities rely upon bringing in foreigners. We do need to fix that problem. We need to improve K-12 education. We need to create incentives for Americans to do PhDs. For example, when you do a PhD, you only get about $23,000, $24,000, $25,000 a year. That's the salary you make after getting a master's. So Americans aren't incented to do that. And for Indians and Chinese and for people from other countries, it's a path to American citizenship, and they readily come here and they'll put up with those salaries. But we need to triple the stipends we pay our PhDs, for example. There are a lot of things we need to do right. But in the meantime, we don't want to lose our competitive edge, and that's what I'm arguing.
And John, do you focus on education at all? Because I was just in Santa Rosa yesterday and met a bunch of kids at the junior college who said because of budget cuts, they're not even going to be able to take their classes next semester.
I don't do a lot of research. I don't specialize in education. I tend to look at wages and the actual and the statutes. What I would add from speaking, and speaking to the programmers, is that a big problem is in the universities itself, in that we focus not on teaching but on research. So we don't put really high qualified teachers in the classroom. Instead, you have one lecturer, in auditoriums with 500 people.
John, the research system is amazing. This is what has given America its edge, because what happens is, as a byproduct of the research, you get innovation. You teach your people how to think critically and so on. This is what's made us who we are. So I would not fault us there. I would fault us for not creating more incentives for our children to study math and science. Another thing we could do, for example, is offer scholarships, more scholarships for engineers. I mean, make master's education free, like some countries have done for Americans. So there are a lot of things we can do to fix the real problems here, and we need to do that as well. I'm not all for skilled immigration. I'm also for improving American competitiveness and giving Americans greater opportunities.
Well, one thing you're saying, to get people bring in more foreign students to study education, that discourages U.S. students from studying.
No, it doesn't. No, American students can compete. I tell you, what we don't want is to close the doors and to have the lowest common denominator. We want our kids competing, with the best and the brightest in the world, and we want them winning because they're competent, not because we've provided them with protection.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Terry. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you're just joining us, we're continuing our Monday series, Agenda for a New Economy. And today we're focusing on foreign workers. If you work in Silicon Valley, we'd love to hear from you. Or if you yourself are a foreign worker and would like to talk about your personal experience, give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's next hear from Safat in Fremont. Hi, Safat. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I've actually been in all sides of this discussion. In fact, I like to say I was an offshore technical writer long before the dot-com boom and the whole outsourcing boom. And too often, I think one thing, we tend to look at this whole thing in extremes. Either, we should have completely unfettered access to foreign workers and also outsourcing, while on the other extreme, it's shut it down completely. What we really need is better and more well-thought-out policies on this matter. I mean, it makes no sense for a company to be able to have its whole research and development and all of that abroad and only its marketing here, and yet have all the advantages of being an American company. That, and to a large extent, it's not good for it, because often the argument is made that we're making the world a more level place. I don't think it's any... India would have made much more progress if companies here had been treating companies in India as foreign companies and doing business with them, rather than just being using them as, I hate to use the word, plantations for cheap labor. And so, I mean, it's not as simple as either extreme would make it. And we really need to do this. I mean, it makes no sense. I've seen myself in the last 6 months at my last job, by the way, I'm between jobs, and at my last job, firing one support engineer and then shipping in two support engineers from your India office to try to do the same job. And of course, they're thrown into a completely new job in a completely new place and are, quite frankly, not quite ready to hit the ground running. It's not as simple as that. There needs to be some sort of pressure and, mechanism to encourage better behavior in the corporate world, quite frankly.
Yeah, you bring up a really interesting point, Safat. Vivek, what about that argument? Safat says that India would have been more competitive if American companies treated them as equals.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's right that there's shades of gray over here, but India's got lots of problems of its own. But something? I did a research project to try to understand why India is succeeding despite its weak education system, despite its lack of infrastructure. And the quick answer was, They've invested massively in workforce development. That the training you get when you join an Infosys or a Wipro is just amazing. 4 months, 14 hours a day, 6 days a week, and the company then invests in education every year. We don't do that anymore. We have to get companies here to go back to the way they were in the 60s and the 70s when they would really invest in their people. And we need to have tax subsidies and breaks, and we need to rethink the entire system so that we're investing in the American worker.
And thank you for calling in, Safat. And Vivek, we have an email for you from Jay Scott. He says, can you please ask Vivek what specifically is his objection to the Durbin-Grassley H-1B L-1 reform bill? And that this is the one that would require workers who want to hire an H-1B guest worker to make a good faith attempt to recruit a qualified American worker.
The spirit with which it was done, basically, I call it mean-spirited xenophobia, because along with it, Grassley goes on TV and starts talking about firing foreigners first. The fact is that this year we don't have a problem. We don't have, we still haven't filled up the quota of H-1Bs. So the issue here isn't numbers. That bill achieved nothing. What it did was that it sent a negative signal all over the world, and it hurt U.S. competitiveness as a result. So the spirit is what I'm objecting to versus the contents of it.
And this was just proposed last week.
Yes.
John.
Grassley has been going on over and over
Sorry,
again
Vivek.
About, firing foreigners first and so on, which doesn't make sense.
And just because you brought up H-1Bs, we haven't talked about the numbers. In 2001, the government distributed 195,000 H-1Bs. In 2008, there are 65,000 slots and 163 applications. Over the past few years, are you seeing the applications increase or decrease?
Well, this year, we haven't filled the quota of 65,000 yet. Last I heard, we were still about, John will know these stats better than I do, but I think there was still about 45 or so.
There are currently have been 45,000 approved for the 60,000 quota. The additional 20,000 U.S. quota has been approved, so that's about 65,000 of quota visas, and there probably would be around 30,000 non-quota visas. So we're probably talking about close to 100,000 in total right now.
And just to make sure I got the numbers right, there's 65,000 slots. In 2008, companies made 163,000 applications.
That's correct. In one day.
And it went down dramatically this year because of the economy.
Yeah.
So companies are not issuing as many applications.
Right. The point I'm making is that the market is taking care of itself, so we don't need to have... We need to fix the entire system. Look at the big picture here. Look at the number of green cards. Look at the number of look at the need. Look at where the distribution is, and do it systematically versus doing this band-aid that Grassley did. And Grassley is doing it basically for to get the populist vote. He's not doing it because he really cares about American competitiveness.
I want to step in here because
John.
I've been looking at because now we're in my area of legislation, and I have that. There have been calls for change reform in the H-1B program since 1996, when the first Department of Labor audit, and there has been absolutely no reform in the program since it. The H-1B program has been completely under the thumb of the lobbyists, and Mr. Grassley and Durbin have introduced the first bill that actually addresses the well-documented problems in the bill, and they pulled no punches. They've introduced the first real reform bill to the H-1B program, and I think it needs to be applauded. This, for example, their bill firmly closes the loophole that allows U.S. workers to be fired and replaced by U.S. workers. And this outstanding abuse has been going on since 1994. Everyone knows it's going on.
But, John, if you really want to fix the real problem, you would address the issue of the million that are already here who are stuck in limbo. I mean, if Durbin and Grassley really cared about making America more competitive, they would give these people green cards and let them start companies. They wouldn't try to close the door and send negative signals all over the world. You understand, how excited you are about the fact that they did something, but the fact is that it just did damage. It did not do good. You're not looking outside the United States. You're looking at it from a very protectionist, point of view, trying to protect a bunch of computer programmers who frankly, the problem here isn't really foreigners. The fact is that companies don't want to hire middle-aged programmers who are still writing code, and they don't want to pay them $120,000 a year. They'd rather hire someone out of school who's making $50,000 a year, because those people typically come in with fresher skills and they're more productive. That's the reality, and we don't admit it. So we basically dance around it. We're trying to band-aid the immigration system by closing the door versus fixing the real problems.
Well, there you have it. If you're a middle-aged and you're being paid well, you're not very very productive. I disagree with that.
Been,
I think
has always
the
been.
Entire body of people who you have offended have just are going to be enraged, and you've added more to the H-1B
opposition. Well, I wrote a business article about that, John. But that's the reality.
We actually got an email from Boris who said that I had a personal experience needed to hire a computer programmer, his boss, my Indian boss and his Indian sidekick insisted on me hiring a young Indian graduate from the Indian Institute of Technology instead of a more qualified older American guy.
Well, that may be the case. I mean, it may well be the case because the fact is that companies prefer younger workers, whether we like it or not. I mean, even if people get pissed off at me for saying that, that is the reality out there. I know Norm Matloff will agree with this one.
Well, we don't have much time, but let's hear from Grant in Santa Cruz, our last caller. Hi, Grant. Thanks for holding.
Oh, thank you, Rose. I appreciate it, and I really appreciate this conversation. I'm an immigrant myself, and I guess I felt in this conversation today that I didn't really feel that any of your guests spoke directly to the responsibility of the corporations in being responsible to their societies, and I think that that is a key element. I also think that it's, well, maybe a little sad that there's no women as guests on this program today, because I think in terms of the disparity in terms of pay of immigrants versus Americans, it also is even greater, I think, in terms of women.
Yeah. And, well, we tried.
Yes.
But thank you. It's a good point.
Yeah. And I also, I just think that there are movements in regards to corporate accountability. There's a movement regarding.
Oh, I think we lost you, Grant, but we have to go anyway because we're almost out of time. So, I'm sorry, 10 seconds each. What about the corporation's responsibility here, Vivek?
Absolutely. Corporations need to be more responsible, but that's a different discussion.
And John?
Yeah, I think you're correct that they need to be more responsible, but right now it's the bottom line for the cheapest body at the at per-hour price.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but to be continued, John Miano is founder of the Programmers Guild. He's now a lawyer. And Vivek Wadhwa is a professor, fellow with the Labor and Work Life Program at Harvard Law School. He's also with the Engineering Department at Duke University. Thank you both for joining us.
It was fun.
Thank you.
And
bye.
Thanks for listening. Thanks for your calls. I'll be right back to let you know what's coming up tomorrow. How do we connect with the humanity of people living with mental illnesses? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about how movies like The Soloist impact our understanding and connection to the mentally ill. How far have we come in relating to and understanding people living with mental illnesses like schizophrenia? You can send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org or join us live at 11 a.m. What have you learned from your own experience with mental illnesses or the experiences of others? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW and the friends of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our daily newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find a link to the Your Call podcast. Malihe Razazan is producer, Ben Temption is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor, Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Hi, Matt Martin, General Manager here at KALW. Join me Wednesday at 1 for the next Manager's Report to the listeners. I'll update you on what's happening at the station, including a new approach to fundraising we think can result in something we all want, shorter membership drives. As always, I'll take your calls and read the emails you send to me at matt@kalw.org. The Manager's Report to the listeners, Wednesday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 KALW.
This is KALW San Francisco, your local public radio station. Coming up next, it's Grit Radio with Laura Flanders. And at 1 o'clock, it's Alternative Radio, Vietnam, the Never-Ending War with Joe Allen. And at 2 o'clock, it's The State We're In from